Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, today on our show, we have the great privilege of talking with Rabbi Steven Sager and Dr. Norman Wurtzba, professors at Duke Divinity School, about hunger, faith, and health.
I'm really looking forward to that, Christy. I learned rather late in life to say blessings around the time of eating, and I feel good about that, and I can credit Rabbi Sager with some of that encouragement.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation about the intersection between food and faith and health.
I know it's
well.
Important to you as
it
well.
It is absolutely important to me.
I know it's also important to you, some of the really good research that matters that can really impact on our listeners. And we're going to be able to talk about being sedentary and how that may link to higher heart risk.
We're going to talk about 1 in 8 American adults still have high cholesterol.
We're going to talk about what it's like to have a purpose in life, and does that create better heart outcomes?
And we'll talk about imaging that identifies cartilage regeneration or rebuilding of cartilage in long-distance runners.
Let's start off talking about actually this purpose in life and how that relates to how long people live. This was research that was in the journal Psychosomatic Medicine, Journal of Biobehavioral Medicine. Fancy title for a journal. I'm not sure psychosomatic, but this is beliefs.
Well, and to get more fancy, this is one of those studies called a meta-analysis, which is where the researchers pull the data from lots of different studies to look, in this case, for over 136,000 participants from 10 different studies, to look at the relationship between purpose in life and the risk of death or of heart disease.
And there were almost 15,000 participants they looked at that had died from any cause. These were mostly elderly patients, and 4,000 had suffered heart attack type events. And they showed that there was a lower risk of death for these people who had a higher sense of purpose in life. This is not just those who believed that there was a, you know, if you were increased stress that you had worse outcomes. This is higher purpose, and there was less heart disease risk, heart attack events.
I know, remarkable. In the United States studies, they look at a sense of purpose or meaning in life or usefulness to others. And in the Japanese studies used in this, they looked at this concept that translates to a life worth living, suggesting that patients who have their perception is that their life is worth living actually have a lower risk of death and a lower risk of heart disease. It's really a beautiful concept and one that also causes us to want to think and address patients who have depression or who maybe are suffering with thoughts that are not towards a life worth living and help people to the best that we can in thinking about purpose and positive direction of life.
Couldn't agree with you more, Christy. And this doesn't suggest that one can just
turn it off. Yeah, yeah, turn your eyes the other way.
Or that this is a causal factor. And they're looking at mechanisms. But I think in light of our guest that'll be talking to us soon about hunger and faith and health, purpose of life, really important. Speaking about things that are important, we do talk a lot about cholesterol and food and diet. And this suggests their next research that's maybe half full, half empty. Some good news and some news that we also have to pay attention to.
Yeah, so we know that high cholesterol is one of the major contributors for heart disease, which is a big reason that people die in our country. So this is a very important topic. And I think the good news, as they looked at cholesterol between 2007 and 2014, the good news is that the percentage of adults who have the high total cholesterol and who have low HDL, or the good cholesterol, did get better. Like, overall, there is less high cholesterol than there used to be.
Yeah, I found this very encouraging. And this was in a data brief of the National Center for Health Statistics. that there has been significant improvement, but that doesn't mean that we can't do better. And because one can lower one's good cholesterol sometimes through diet, sometimes through medication. One can potentially raise one's HDL. That's
through
the
exercise.
Good cholesterol through exercise. And actually, that's going to be our very next research that matters. So there's a lot of work to be done, but yes, it seems to be paying off.
Yeah, the bad news, roughly 12% of Americans still had high total cholesterol. 18.5% still had low levels of the good cholesterol. So we have some work to go. And it will be something I think that ties into our conversation today about food and being thoughtful about both what we eat and how we treat our bodies.
So speaking about how we treat our bodies, Christy, we're anytime that one's around holiday periods and times, we recognize that it's easy to eat a little bit more, but particularly maybe to spend more time being sedentary. And this next research would suggest even if you're spending time watching that TV, you better get up and move.
That's right. This was a study that was published in the European Journal of Cardiovascular Prevention, or Heart Prevention. And it was research done from the Ottawa Heart Institute looking at 278 patients who have known heart disease. And they had already gone through a cardiac rehab program, and they'd already learned a little bit about how to improve their levels of exercise in the long term. But then they followed them with this activity monitor for 9 days.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd want that activity monitor on me for 9 days. You might find things I don't want to hear, but I probably do need to hear, because it found out that men spent more time sitting than women, an average of an hour more a day, probably because you, Christy, and women in general are doing more, a lot of household chores and other things that kind of get you up. And so we need to be helping with that and doing more. But that also that those who were sedentary had a higher body mass index, lower heart disease fitness, and lower use of the muscles of the heart that get it really in good shape.
Some practical tips that come from this. I mean, it matters. If you have heart disease, it matters if you're sedentary. You need to get up and move. And some practical tips would be to give up and move every 30 minutes. A lot of people have a Fitbit or some sort of thing. I have it on my watch now where it'll trigger me every hour to get up and stand.
Can it send me a note?
It could. I'll text it to you every 30 minutes, Adam. Get up and move every 30 minutes. Stand up during TV commercials. Set a timer to take breaks from your desk. Go to lunch breaks outside instead of eating at the computer. And to monitor those patterns as best as you can to keep your body moving.
Our last research that matters, Christy, is about regeneration of cartilage in long-distance runners. And I'm not talking about just running 3 miles, 6 miles, even 10 miles. We're talking about something way out there.
Yeah, this was a foot race that took place from April 19th to June 21, 2009. And it involved running 4,487 kilometers, starting in southern Italy and ending in the North Cape in Norway. Without a day of rest.
That's a couple thousand miles.
Oh, my goodness. I cannot imagine.
Sign me up.
Next okay.
Year.
Good luck. Because this is looking at what happens with people's knees and their ligaments and ankles.
Oh, my goodness.
As well.
Because I've had the knee surgery, the meniscus surgery. But what is interesting about this research is that it suggests that there can be, particularly at least in these endurance athletes, there could be some regeneration, that there wasn't just complete deterioration getting worse, worse, worse.
Yeah.
I think that's fascinating. I've never heard that before.
I know they took these mobile MRI scanners and would scan the runners every 3 to 4 days and then follow that over time. And they found that there was wear down in those joints, but then there was a lot of regeneration of the cartilage over time, which I think is just remarkable. And it's also part of the mystery of the human body, don't you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, I think it is mysterious. I'm not suggesting that any of our patients go out and do this sort of thing as a way of regenerating cartilage. I don't know if it works in the same way in us and others, but it is interesting and suggests there's more to the story than we've heard. Well, Christy, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had an interesting new research about findings about cartilage and regeneration.
About 1 in 8 American adults still having high cholesterol.
About a purpose in life, maybe having better chances of living longer.
And about heart disease patients who sit need to get moving to improve that heart health.
We're going to take a short break. Christy and I are going to get up and move around. And when we return, we'll be talking with Rabbi Stephen Sager, Dr. Norman Wurzba, professors at Duke Divinity School about hunger, faith, and health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we have the great privilege to talk with Rabbi Steven Sager and Dr. Norman Wiersbe, professors at Duke University School, about hunger, faith, and health.
We are so glad to have both of you with us, Dr. Wiersbe and Rabbi Sager. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
For having us.
Now, give us a little sense, and maybe we'll start with you, Rabbi Sager. Give us a little sense of your story. Who are you? And
why are you here?
What is the meaning of your existence? No, we'll get to that later in the conversation. But give us a little introduction about your story.
I came to Durham in 1978 to be the rabbi of a conservative synagogue. I served as the rabbi in that pulpit for 32 years, and I retired. I am the rabbi emeritus of the synagogue, and I have another career, which has to do with education, primarily through the vehicle of conversation. An organization, Sicha, in English does mean conversation, and it really claims that the essential kind of learning that we do is in conversation with ancient texts, in conversation with our own lived experience in ancient texts, in conversation between religious traditions, between religion and science, between any kinds of elements and people who want to engage in conversation. It builds community. It builds empathy. It builds a cadre of fellow travelers.
Well, we're looking forward to this conversation with you. Dr. Wiersbe, as we pull you into the conversation, tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. I'm a farm kid from Western Canada who then realized that farming wasn't going to be a viable future for me, economically speaking. And so I went off to school and studied philosophy and theology and started teaching in the areas of agriculture, which are a bit unusual for philosophers and theologians. But I really want people to think about fundamental things and want to help them figure out what are the meanings of things, including something as basic as food, because it's not something that shows up on the syllabus for a lot of courses in theology or in philosophy. So yeah, I'm just having a good time introducing people to some new topics.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here introducing us. And I know we're going to talk about some books you've written, including Food and Faith, The Theology of Eating. But maybe we can just understand from each of your perspectives, maybe Rabbi Sager, how does your faith influence how you think about food? And is this a daily sort of thought, and how and why?
Faith has to do with practice. Faith has to do with how it is that we are faithful. How do we behave, even if the heart's not in it at the particular moment? How is it that we practice living in a community? How is it that we practice taking care of ourselves? Those elements of our lives that we know are important, are beneficial, are nutritious, as it were, both in terms of food and other. And how do we implement that? Religious language, language of religious imagination, is one way of making sense, making the world intelligible, and telling a story that is a deep story, a soul story, the story of a people. When a person eats, when a community eats, when a people sees itself at table sharing, there is a moment that invites religious language. It invites a certain kind of practice, a certain way of valuing and of sharing. There is an ethic. There is a morality. There's a way of connecting to the world. Every single time we eat something, there is a deep grounding and a very high aspiration. It's a deeply religious moment. People have a talent for it, but if one gets the inkling that this is important, one can develop the practice. So faith in terms of practice, maybe not in terms of belief. Maybe there's not a deep theology that undergirds what it is that you're doing, but you feel that this is the way of a particular people or a way of valuing a certain language, a certain kind of approach, a certain framework of culture.
And Dr. Wiersbe, as you think of it from the Christian perspective, I would imagine there are a lot of similarities. But share with us a little bit about the meaning of food and faith and how that might differ or be the same in the Christian faith.
Yeah, I think there's some good similarities. I mean, in part because the Christian story doesn't make sense apart from the Jewish story. And so there's a lot of mutual exchange that can happen. And I've learned a great amount about how to think about food, and I think about blessing, for instance, and saying grace from Jewish friends. But I think one of the key issues that I think listeners need to have in mind is when we talk about something like food, which seems so ordinary, we discover that, in fact, it isn't. And when we think about food as simply a commodity, the only thing you're going to worry about is the price. Is it available? Is it cheap? Is it there in sufficient quantity? But if you've ever been someone who grows food, as a farmer or a gardener or someone like that, you discover that food is really a holy mystery. It's a gift. Because as a farmer, you put your seed in the ground and you hope that there will be germination, but you don't control it. And what our thinking about food as a commodity does is it gives us a really superficial approach to food. But think of it this way. For any of us to eat, others have to die. Right. And there's no getting around that, even if you're a vegetarian. And so the question in eating, and we don't put it this way most of the time, but every time we eat, we have in the back somewhere the question, how are we worthy of another's life and death? And so we're constantly being brought into holy mysteries when we eat. And when we eat well, what we are really doing is we're trying to extend a fellowship of love. But to do that, we need institutions, we need rituals, we need practices that help us understand the depth of what we're doing.
So let me ask a question of you both. As food, it's this common element that we share, and we do share communally. Hunger is a different animal at some levels, and it seems that it all of a sudden we go into Christianized realm sometimes, which is we have patients that are hungry. We know that when they come to see us, and it's difficult sometimes to really worry about one's health when one's physically hungry. Help us understand from your perspective, physical hunger, where that plays in your work.
Well, physical hunger, of course, is the prompt for that communal table. It's the prompt for those moments of recognizing something deep and also something that is high. This is a very interesting and deceptively complicated phrase in the Bible in Deuteronomy, where we hear, you shall eat, bless, and be satisfied. You shall eat, bless, and be satisfied. Eat, I know about that. Bless, I know about that too. There's a ritual formula for blessing. Be satisfied? What does that mean? Are we talking about minimum daily requirements, certain nutrients and vitamins? Are we talking about being satiated? Are we talking about being too full to take another bite? Are we talking about a satisfaction that is very superficial? Is it deeper? Is it something that actually comes from the food? Is it something for which the food is a carrier, which is to say the larger community table that is being shared, eating with friends or family or children, or celebrating a feast day, marking part of the calendar, part of the rhythm? Satisfaction and the satisfaction of hunger, I should say, is a complicated issue. Hunger at a basic physical, biological level is certainly the prompt.
Yeah, hunger is a fascinating and complicated thing. On the one hand, hunger is the sign that you're alive, right? Which is good, because if you weren't hungry, you'd be dead. But at the same time, hunger is something that is easily manipulated. So for instance, we can think about hunger just in terms of filling a number of calories, or we can think about hunger in terms of filling deep spiritual or emotional cravings that we have. And so the phenomenon of a comfort food is often compensatory for other things that we lack. And we know that people, especially food industries, have learned to manipulate our hungers so that we can work with those cravings to maximize caloric intake, which means profitability for food products.
Oh, gosh, this is going so fast, which is just a fascinating conversation. And I'm sad that we have to take a short break, but I'm very excited that we will be able to continue this conversation when we return. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Rabbi Stephen Sager and Dr. Norman Wurzba, professors at Duke Divinity School, about hunger, faith, and health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Rabbi Steven Sager and Dr. Norman Wurzba, professors at Duke Divinity School, about hunger, faith, and health. And both of you have shared fascinating elements of how hunger, faith, and health are related. And I wonder, Dr. Wurzba, if you might share with us something from Scripture, from the Bible, about hunger and faith and how those interplay.
Sure. In John's Gospel, there's a memorable story starting in chapter 6. There are a number of people, 5,000, the Scripture suggests, that are out with Jesus listening to him speak. And they're getting hungry. They've been out for a whole day. And they're wondering, what are they going to eat? And the disciples say, it's time to send them home so they can go get some food. And Jesus says, no, I'm going to feed them. And they say, but there's no food. And they says, well, there's this one boy who's got a few loaves and some fish. And so Jesus says, get it, and we'll bless it. And in doing so, the food multiplies, feeds everybody. And it's an amazing story. And we're told that the people rushed upon him to make him king. And you can understand why, because for a population where people are known to be hungry a lot, physically hungry, who wouldn't want to have as their king someone who can produce food on demand? But Jesus turns it around on them and he says, look, I'm not like ordinary bread. I'm not even like the manna that was sent down from heaven to the Israelites as they were marching out of Egypt. He says, I'm the bread of life. And what I'm here to do is I'm here to deal with your spiritual, your existential hungers. And that hunger is most importantly a hunger to learn to love and to be loved. And so him calling himself the bread of life, which then, of course, becomes central to the Christian practice of the Eucharist, becomes that place where we learn to participate in God's loving ways as revealed in the life of Jesus so that we can satisfy the deep spiritual hungers that we have as people.
You know, Rabbi Sager, as I'm hearing, and I think you mentioned manna, and I'm thinking about in the Old Testament, the manna in the desert that had to be enough for people. But for someone who's really hungry, is it enough that the faith that it's going to be there tomorrow? Can you fault the Israelites who wanted to take more than the daily portion of manna because they were really didn't believe that it was going to be there tomorrow?
Well, I would choose exactly that story as a parallel to the one that that Norman just told us, because manna, a character in his story, is a character in the story that you mentioned, Adam. Manna, or what's-its, let's say. What is that stuff on the ground? Manhu, which in Hebrew means, what's that? That's what the people say. And Moses says, you're right, that's what it is. We call it manna, after the Greek. Well, this manna was a project, an extended project to get people to learn to live with sufficiency and to satisfy hungers, not only as individuals, but also as a community. And there were miraculous elements and controls that the Bible presents about the manna in this extraordinary holy fantasy about what does it mean for a community to learn how to live on its own, to learn how to be together, to learn how to be a people. This manna is going to descend with the dew. Its residue is going to stay on the ground through the morning. You will go and pick it up. Don't take too much. If you do, when you get home, there's only going to be a certain measure. If you take too little, thinking, you know what, let other people take, or that's all right, I'll eat tomorrow, whatever kind of self-sacrificing way you have or self-aggrandizing way you have or gluttonous way you have, it won't matter. You have to learn bit by bit that this is what you have, this is what you're going to get. Through this kind of miraculous story, the Bible starts to tell us about how people really learn to trust that there is a way to make it through until tomorrow, and tomorrow there will be sufficiency as well.
When we think about food and faith, especially this time of the year, and charitable donations or food banks or ways that we are focused towards giving, How does giving help towards spiritual health, and how does that play in with what we're talking about, food and hunger?
Well, I think the deep spiritual lesson in eating is fundamentally that we live only by sharing, right? We share in the lives of each other, most basically by preparing food for each other, by consuming each other, right? We don't like to speak that directly about it, but that's in fact what we do when we eat. And so the question then about sharing is so important, because if you are the person who only ever takes, you step outside your appointed role as a creature. And from a biblical or theological point of view, understanding yourself to be a creature is fundamental. Because if you think you are not a creature and perhaps think of yourself as a god, you won't think of yourself as having limits or having this need to share with other people, because you are placed on this earth, I would suggest, to be a participant in the sharing ways of God.
So help us understand, you two are remarkable. You have remarkable insights into our faith and how that informs daily living. How did the two of you get to know each other, and what are y'all doing right now? Why are you both here?
Well, the truth is that we were introduced at a restaurant.
Over food. Okay.
That's right. We were.
You were the only two saying blessings?
We broke bread together.
No, our hosts are just the fabulous couple, Arthur and Anya Gordon.
Yes. And their world is food and the preparation of food and sustainability. And they brought us together, and we got a chance to share these interests. And I began to plan an interfaith day of learning that involves this topic of hunger. And I knocked on Norman's door and said, would you like to join? Is there a way that you can come and be a part of this group of fellow travelers who are going to learn sacred stories about hunger and learn how to share something about each other's way of looking at the world through this particular lens? And he said yes.
And what do you hope to achieve by bringing people together for an interfaith day of learning, and which I could imagine be days of learning, which could also ultimately be another book? What are your aspirations?
Well, I mean, there are many. I think one of the real problems historically is that food has been used as a way to keep people separate from each other. Right. So, for instance, just the famous story in Acts is, you know, Peter's not going to eat with Cornelius because you don't eat with Gentiles. And food can be an excuse to keep people apart. But interfaith conversation, interfaith eating, I think become wonderful ways to break down the walls that separate us, that sometimes the suspicion rules or the fear rules. And Lord knows in our world we have far too much fear and suspicion. And my hope would be that as people learn to eat together and fellowship around eating, that some of this fear and hatred and suspicion can dissipate.
Nice.
That is beautiful. And with the focus on love instead of fear, what piece of advice would each of you give to our listeners on how food, either in what they eat or how they or we give it and share it with others, can improve one's spiritual health, especially during holiday seasons?
I think taking a moment to recognize one's place in the world that orchestrates and is orchestrated by food and its production. I am a part of something much larger than myself. Again, this can summon the language of religious imagination if one has a religious tradition. If not, a meditative moment is just as powerful and thoughtful and important. But here I am about to eat. For what purpose? What am I fueling? What am I fueling myself for? What's the outcome? What did it take to make this moment of eating happen? And how does it further me? And how do I make that happen for someone else? A moment such as that before eating, I think, satisfies a certain kind of hunger beyond the food.
Yeah, I think also saying grace is a very, very important act, because what you do in saying grace is you don't just offer some pious words, but you try to genuinely become grateful for the food that is there. And to be grateful for the food means you have to know its history. And if it's a history of abuse or a history of alienation, those things need to be addressed. So saying grace would be very important. And then I think also trying to grow even one plant would be very instructive for people, because as strictly the consumers of food, we have forgotten something about the fragility and the gift of life. And growing food will teach you some of that.
What beautiful advice. Thank you for taking these moments with us and for reflecting in this way. This is a beautiful conversation.
Yeah, you know, thinking about blessings and breaking bread should make us all appreciate the relationship between hunger and food and faith and, for Christy and I, health. So spiritual health, physical health. On behalf of Your Health listeners, we want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question of the day.
My wife just had her second cancer diagnosed. The first was 10 years ago with cancer of the uterus. This time, she has cancer of the breast. Should we have all our family members tested for something genetic going on? She is overweight, but she doesn't smoke, even though I do.
Well, that is a very complicated question, and thank you so much. And we're so sorry to hear about the second cancer. That's one is equally upsetting, and getting two, it makes you think, what's going on?
Right. And sometimes there are certain types of cancers that can go together, particularly ovarian cancer, which is near the uterus, and breast cancer can sometimes go together in a genetic way. There also could be other elements like a person's weight or smoking or other things that could raise one's risk. But your real question is, should all of the family members have genetic testing? And that is very, very complicated on lots of levels, both of the usefulness of the information and how you would go about doing that.
Yeah, I don't think we're yet at the place where everyone's recommending that everyone with every cancer diagnosis go out and do genetic testing, but it's becoming more increasingly on people's minds. A second cancer, well, that may be worth a conversation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt to have a conversation if you wanted to talk with genetic counseling. But one thing you mentioned, Christy, I want to go back to. In this particular case, one thing is linked to both cancers, and that is being overweight. We know that being overweight can cause up to 20% of cancers, particularly the ones that you have that could be linked to that. So we would encourage you, again, talk with your doctor about trying to limit your possibilities by getting to a better weight. And then we'd also say for the spouse here, we really want you to quit smoking because exposure to secondhand smoke can also be linked to cancer. So the things we can easily or more easily control and lower our risk.
Absolutely. Let's take our next House Call question. Daniel?
I'm a 78-year-old man with Parkinson's disease. I've had it for 10 years. It's getting worse, but I can still walk around and do most of my daily activities. I know that this disease ultimately gets worse, so when do you think I should think about end-of-life decisions?
We've talked about this on the show, Adam, and I would say to you, we're glad that you're doing so well and that you're able to do your daily activities. That is wonderful. And this is the time when you are well, when you're clear-minded, when you are healthy, it's always the time to be thinking and talking openly with your family members and with your physicians about end-of-life decisions.
You know, Christy, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm thinking about my wife and myself. We actually have had end-of-life decisions with our children, so we wanted to let them know what our wishes were at this point in our life, and also if something were to happen to them so that we have some direction. But we also know that we can revisit this at different points and times in our life. And in this particular case, you might make some decisions now that may be different than you might make 2 years from now about what you would want done and how that works out, because it's not like it's written in stone. It's not
right.
The Ten Commandments of this is the only way it can be. It can change. So there's no real harm in thinking about and doing it now. I agree with you.
And there's a lot of benefit, because if you wait until you're not able to communicate those things, that can both leave you with things happening to you that are not your wishes, but also put a lot of pressure on your family to make decisions without that guidance. So it's always the right time. And what a great question. Thank you for sharing.
Daniel, what's our very next House Call?
Our mother was recently diagnosed with multiple myeloma, but she has no symptoms. It was picked up in a routine blood test and confirmed with a biopsy. the doctor said it did not need to be treated, but it seems odd that we would not treat a cancer.
Well, you know, this is a good question and one that's not intuitively obvious on some circumstances, but there are some times in which one doesn't treat a cancer when it's very early, particularly if the treatments may or may not be good or may not be beneficial. There are certain types of chronic leukemias that sometimes can be indolent for long periods of time, or one can have a lymphoma that's picked up on just a CAT scan or a chest x-ray that one, you know, or diseases like sarcoid, an inflammatory disease. So there's sometimes where the doctors can say it may not necessarily be beneficial. I don't think we could say for you whether or not your treatment, we don't know enough about this, but there could be that it's so early in the process that they don't feel that it would give you a benefit. This is a great question to really ask your doctor. Why do they say you wouldn't benefit? And when do they think you might benefit?
And we'll have our excellent health sciences librarians put up a link about what is multiple myeloma. But it is a cancer within the cells that can weaken bones and can kind of chip away at bones. It can be very painful to people, too. So, and it's complicated in terms of your question. I agree, Adam. It's not straightforward. And there are treatments that can help either reduce the pain or lengthen one's life. So the timing of when that happens involves some conversations with your doctors and your specialists.
And clearly right now, you have no symptoms. You're doing great. So we're so happy to hear that. Daniel, what's our very last house call?
Can you tell me what is an anal fistula? My doctor told me that I had it, but I do not really understand it and why I can't just take antibiotics rather than have surgery.
Well, a fistula, which is not a pleasant-sounding term, I must say, is a communication between two areas.
Like a tunnel.
It's like a tunnel or a cave, and none of us really want this in our bottoms, which is what this is. It's in a fistula in the rectum, in the anus, in the bottom.
Right. And so the tunnel that sometimes can happen between the skin and the rectum can get infected. It can be very, very painful. And it does often need some sort of surgical assistance.
Yeah,
I mean, it may need surgery.
Because antibiotics can maybe kind of temporarily help cut down on swelling and infection. But it is like a tunnel. And you think about a river that's coming through. I don't know about the analogy here, but you got a river coming through and you got a little tributary going around. Unless you block up that tributary completely, which is what the surgery does, they cut out the abnormal cells there and then they sew it all back together so that tunnel can't exist anymore. And frequently that is what needs to be done. People go on for long periods of time with kind of drainage and infection and uncomfortable before this is sometimes diagnosed. So that's a really good question. We appreciate it.
Right. And having the surgery is most likely the very right thing to do. Thank you for sharing your questions today. Thoughtful questions and elements that I think have benefited many of our listeners. We want you to share your questions, share your stories by writing us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. You can also go to our health app, just search Your Health for a free download.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Dr. Norman Wurzba and Rabbi Stephen Sager. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And Christy, we should just wish all of our listeners a wonderful holiday season at this time of year. My wishes would be for blessings and lack of hunger for people. And in light of some of our other shows, peace in the world and more understanding.
Agreed. And hopefully this conversation with Dr. Wurzba and Rabbi Sager also will allow us to be grateful for our blessings, to take that moment in grace and in prayer and reach out and share with one another.
Amen.
Happy holidays, everyone.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.